Anatomy and Physiology, Gulf Coast State College. Let's continue our discussions about the skeletal system by taking a look at the remaining bones of the axial skeleton, including the hyoid bone, vertebral column, sternum, and ribs. We're going to check them out one at a time in that order, beginning with this gorgeous picture from your textbook of the hyoid bone. Let's start with our root words. Oid means like freakoid means like a freak, and high means U, and it is a U-shaped bone, and that's exactly how it got its name. Let's check out the picture from your textbook. Pay attention to the location of the hyoid bone. It is positioned in the anterior neck just below the mandible. Interestingly, this is the only bone in the human body that does not articulate with, that means does not form a joint with, any other bone. That kind of sounds like a test question, doesn't it? It does, however, make attachments with some muscles, including several of the muscles in the tongue, throat, and neck region. Let's get clinical here for a minute. What about a fracture of this bone? Is that significant? You bet it is. And if you're a fan of those TV shows like CSI and they find that this bone has been fractured, it's almost always an indication that your patient has been strangulated. Let's get to the real deal. Here's a superior view from one of the human bones from the lab. This is anterior, this is posterior, and here, as promised, is a perfect U-shaped bone. No other bone in the human body that you will see will ever look like this. You should never miss it on the test. Also, it's got these little fang-like projections up front. They're not called fangs, they're called horns. You're not responsible for that for my course, but they are cool to look at anyway. Next comes a right lateral view of the same thing, showing you the never-miss-it U-shaped bone with the little fangs on it called horns. Now we move on to the all-important vertebral column. Here is a drawing from your textbook off to the right. Notice this is anterior, this is posterior. Let's hit on some basics. I'll trace over the bony vertebral column. You should know in summary that it's made up of 26 bones. And in an average adult human being, it measures roughly 26 inches long. Well, that's easy for my pea brain to remember. 26 bones, 26 inches. But what's the breakdown? Because we're A&P students. We got to know more than that. Let's start up top. In the neck, these vertebrae are called cervical vertebrae. And there are 7 cervical vertebrae. You know your root word cervical refers to the neck, because if you ever put a cervical collar on a trauma victim to stabilize their neck region, you put it around their neck. Below that are 12 more vertebrae in the thorax, conveniently called the thoracic vertebrae. Then in the lower back region are 5 lumbar vertebrae, followed by 1 bone called a sacrum, and at the very bottom, a single bone called the coccyx. Add it all together, and that comes up to 26. Well, what's the vertebral column made of? Well, mostly bone and other connective tissue. For what? What's the purpose? I mean, why do we have this thing called the vertebral column? It has many important functions, and you should be writing these all down. In my mind, the most critical function is to protect the delicate, fragile, small, precious spinal cord. Other purposes includes it gives strength to our body. At the same time, it provides flexibility, it acts as a shock absorber, and it serves as attachment points for muscles and other bones. Then we have to talk about the curvature. Certainly you've noticed that it's not straight, it's curved. And those curves have a name. There are 4 normal curves starting at the top in the neck. Thank goodness someone called that the cervical curve, formed by the 7 cervical vertebrae. I remember that bows forward by remembering an old phrase. Did you ever hear the term stick your neck out? Well, that remembers that the cervical curve bows out if anybody asks you in the future. The curve in the thorax, yep, called the thoracic curve, I just outlined there with my fancy PowerPoint, and it bows backwards. How do I remember that? I just remember the phrase sunken chest, and then I remember it goes backwards. The third curve in the lower back region, called the lumbar curve, it bows forwards, and I just remember my lower belly bows forwards. Not really, that's just a memorization technique, but that's how I never forget this. Last curve is called the sacral curve. It's formed by the sacrum, and I just kind of remember I got a sac in my back because that's S-A-C, the first three letters of sacrum, and that reminds me it bows backwards. Well, what for? I mean, why do we have these curves? Why not straight? Answers, I'll give you a couple of them. Certainly for strength, imagine it's much easier to snap a straight stick than one that's kind of curly. Also, it provides for better balance. I mean, think how hard it is to balance a perfectly straight stick. In anatomy and physiology, over and over again, we'll talk about how the form matches the function, or how I like to say, the design matches the mission. Coincidence that it's shaped like this? I think not. As AAP students, I think you should know more. I want you to know some abnormalities of vertebral column curvature, starting with the most common one you've probably heard of over here to your left, called scoliosis. Root words, always helpful. Osis just means a condition. Scolio means crooked, and it's a crooked spine. You can see it in a drawing to your left here, showing this spinal cord being bowed laterally. For each of these conditions, I want you to know one common cause that's associated with getting this condition. And for this first one, I'll just tell you poor posture. Poor posture is one of the causes of scoliosis. Of course, you like to catch it early to try to prevent all kind of problems. And if you do an internet search, the surgeries to correct this are just fascinating, using plates and screws and all sorts of cool stuff. Middle condition called kyphosis. Kyph means hump. Don't call it humposis, number one, because that's incorrect, plus it just doesn't sound right. Where do you see this most commonly? In the elderly. What happens as we age, we lose bone mass in what we'll call the bodies of the vertebrae, and then we tend to hunch forward. Layman's term, you might call it a hunchback, but the real term on the test, you will call it kyphosis. Last but not least, off to the right, we have a condition called lordosis. The root word in there just means bent. In layman's terms, some people just call this hollow back. But the way I remember it, once again, for lordosis with the L, is that my lower belly sticks out. And that reminds me, the condition I want you to know that's associated with this is pregnancy. And in pregnancy, you've seen this posture where they sort of have that hollowed out back and, of course, the big baby belly poking out forward. Now, don't call this, you know, pregnant osis or anything like that, because on the test I'll just laugh and put a smiley face and you won't get any points. Please write down lordosis. On the next slide, we get back to the real deal digital photo of a specimen you'll study in lab, mostly showing the bones of the vertebral column. There's a little occipital bone sitting up there on top of the first cervical vertebrae, and there are hip bones on here as well. We'll talk about the hip bones later. But let's bust this thing down literally from top to bottom, starting with the very first cervical vertebrae that I have on the next slide, and here it comes. Superior view, this would be anterior, this would be posterior. This is the first cervical vertebrae. Some people call this C1. That's probably the most common way you'll name it while you're in the hospital. But for our course, we want you to know the proper name of this bone in order to get full credit. And the name is Atlas. It's called the Atlas because of the Greek mythology figure you may have seen. They show this big, hunky, muscular dude holding the earth right on his shoulders. And that's why somebody named this bone atlas because this holds up our head. So like Atlas holds up the globe, this atlas holds up our skull. I have a visual though, because I have to have a visual for everything in the lab, especially. You have to take away at least one thing from everything you're responsible for in lab, some visual clue that you could hang your hat on test day, so you know it is what it is and nothing else, so you always get it right. To me, two things about this bone visually. It looks just kind of like a plain oval. I mean, there's nothing really hanging off of it. There's no junk hanging. We'll see on all the other bones, there's stuff hanging off of it. As a matter of fact, this bone has no body and it has no spinous process, which as you will see is rare for vertebrae in general. But here's my better visual. To me, it looks like a shark's mouth. Anyone else see a shark's mouth? Like in Alvin's Island? When I see the shark mouth, I know it's the atlas. One other feature here I want to point out on this slide. Check out these two little holes to the side. There's one there. There's one there. You know a name for a hole in anatomy is a foramen to allow goodies to get through. These holes are called the transverse foramen. Why? Transverse means off to the side. Like if you transverse or traverse the country, you go across the country. So these are the holes to the side that you will call the transverse foramen. And something very important goes through there. They are the vertebral arteries. What a great name. Vertebral arteries go through the cervical vertebrae, and the vertebral arteries supply blood to the back of our melon. You know what I mean, to the back of our brain. Another angle coming up on the next slide. This is an anterior view of the atlas. Just wanted to show it to you. It's a real human bone, but the way to really identify it is from that top-down shark mouth view that we have. Let's move to our second cervical vertebrae, and here it is in a superior view. This would be anterior, this would be posterior, and commonly it is referred to as C2, but the proper name you must know for full credit in our courses is this bone is called the axis. Why? You know, axis means things are kind of lined up in a line. Well, this bone is the only vertebrae that has this projection that we'll see on the next slide pops up superiorly in a line. And that's why somebody named it the axis. But here comes the money shot right there. There is, without a doubt, the bone called the axis. Cervical vertebrae number 2. How do I never miss it? Well, look at that projection superiorly. That's kind of up in a line. That's why it got its name. Furthermore, you must know the name of that projection because we name everything in anatomy. Somebody called that the dens, D-E-N-S. Why? Use your root words. What does dental or dentist refer to? It means a tooth. And someone who found this years ago says it looked like a tooth. I guess it does, kind of real funky looking tooth, but the point is, once you see the tooth, you know you're looking at the axis. Then for fun, but also to show you how the bones work, I put the atlas on top of the axis in an anterior view using real human bones from the lab, and this shows you how they fit so nicely together. You can barely see a little tip of the axis poking up here. What this joint allows us to do is pivot or rotate our head. So this beautiful joint is what allows our children to tell us no. Next comes a top-down view. Here it is. Again, this would be anterior. This would be posterior, beautifully showing the dens in the joint between the axis and the atlas. And then what I did next for fun was put the skull on top of this combination, and this was a fun balancing act to do in lab. Here it is. Let me try to orient you. Here's a plastic model of a human skull. You could see this is anterior because there's the teeth. This is posterior with some of the structures that we studied. Here is the hole called the foramen magnum, remember? And then the occipital condyles. There's one shown very nicely. The smooth knuckle of bone forming a joint with the Atlas. This allows us to rock our head this way so we could say yes. One of the reasons I wanted to show you this slide was to get clinical again. You've all heard of and will see whiplash injuries. They can be from minor to very severe. In a whiplash injury, like when you get rear-ended, what happens is you have sudden hyperextension followed by sudden hyperflexion, and you can tear ligaments, you can strain and tear muscles, you could break bones. But one of the most deadly things that could happen is in that type of an accident, the dens, right, that little tooth-like projection can actually get driven up through the foramen magnum. Who remembers what sits there? That's where the brainstem is, which contains the vital centers that control our heart and our breathing. And that's exactly why you may have heard of cases of sudden death from whiplash type injuries. To further emphasize this, I have a top-down view when I was trying to keep all these bones together in the lab. This would be anterior, this would be posterior. This, of course, is the occipital bone, foramen magnum, the atlas right underneath of that, and then there is the tooth. That's the dens of the axis, which can be driven into the brainstem in those horrific accidents. Let's move on to the next slide from the laboratory I took, showing a typical cervical vertebrae. I know this isn't the atlas because it's not a shark mouth and it has other things hanging. See this thing here poking off the back, this process we'll talk about later. It's also got a hunky piece of bone here that the atlas didn't have. It's not the atlas because it's not the smooth oval. It's got some junk hanging. Certainly not the axis because there's no tooth. So every other cervical vertebrae, you have our permission, or at least my permission in my course, to just call a cervical vertebrae. How do I know right off the bat it's at least a cervical vertebrae? The key is our old friend, the transverse foramen. Once you see them, you know you can narrow it down immediately to the cervical vertebrae. Let's put it all together on a picture from your textbook. Off to your left is a right lateral view of the vertebral column. This is anterior, posterior, and shaded in gray up top shows us our seven cervical vertebrae. Then we just pluck them out and turn them around, showing a posterior view of just the cervical vertebrae. So I think that's a really nice picture to try to put it all together, literally put it all together. Let's get back to the real deal. Here's a photo. This is an anterior view of all seven cervical vertebrae together. You're seeing the occipital bone sitting there on top as well. But the main thing I wanted to emphasize was the transverse foramen have a purpose. They allow the vertebral arteries to cruise up through and supply blood to the back of our brain. And yes, all seven cervical vertebrae have them. Even shown here nicely on the axis that I was not able to show you nicely on a prior slide. Comes a right lateral view next of the same exact thing, showing you vertebral arteries going through transverse foramen and headed to feed the back of the brain. I'll follow this up with a beautiful summary slide from your textbook, pictures of cervical vertebrae, including a superior view of the atlas. Again, I see a shark mouth, nothing hanging, just a plain oval. We go down below, perfect views of the axis showing the tooth that you will call the dens. There's no way anyone should ever miss this. Please notice transverse foramen there as well. And then all other cervical vertebrae, you just call cervical vertebrae. The only two you have to know by name are the atlas and the axis. If you've looked at your lab study sheets as well as your lecture notes, you know that there are multiple parts of a vertebrae we must know. Most instructors and most textbooks choose, for whatever reason, a thoracic vertebrae to review the basic parts that almost all vertebrae have. So we'll do that here. This is a superior view of a real thoracic vertebrae. This is anterior. This is posterior. Let's bust down the parts and roll through the list. Number one, this big hunk of beef here is called the body. And as you study parts of the human body, you will learn that this organ and almost every other organ, the main meat of it is called the body. The next piece we'll look at is this projection of bone poking out posteriorly. You know a projection of bone is called a process, so you got half of it right there. See how easy it is? And specifically, this one is called the spinous process. If you were to do this, and I'm not telling you to, but if you were to run your hand right up and down the middle of your back and feel those little bumps, maybe before today, before you took the course, you would have called that your spine. Well, not really. Those are your spinous processes of your spinal column. And that's one way I never forget what these are called. Then, of course, more processes. Off to the side here, projections of bones. And recall our word for across is transverse, so those are called the transverse processes. The next thing we're going to look at is this big hole right here. Some of you noticed that on the cervical vertebrae, or were probably thinking, hey, why are you skipping that hole, Dr. Gonshore? Well, I was saving it, all that excitement for right now to tell you. That hole in the middle of the vertebrae, of course, it's called a foramen, because that's the name for a hole. And guess what some genius called it? They called it the vertebral foramen, because it's the hole in the vertebrae. But what is that for? Well, if you stack the vertebrae together, all those vertebral foramen form something you should know called the vertebral cavity. You already know we have holes in our bones to allow goodies to pass through. And in this case, the main thing I want you to know that passes through there is the delicate, precious spinal cord. Yes, of course all those holes have a purpose. These next parts that just popped up are typically the most challenging for students to understand. So I'm going to try to give you a few tips and tricks and mnemonics so you can nail these. Here we go. Back here where my arrow is right now, between the spinous and the transverse process, and here it is, of course, same thing on the other side, is a little plate of bone. And somebody who had nothing better to do decided to give that a name. That is called the lamina. What does lamina mean? Greek root word. Lamina means a layer. Like if you laminate something, like in the old days, we would laminate photographs and driver's licenses. It means a layer. And I encourage you in lab to grab it and feel it with your hands. And it does feel more like a flat plate of bone. And that's exactly how it got its name. And I can never get past that root word, lamina or laminate, and without remembering a story about my youngest daughter. Now, this was years ago, so don't go looking for things. But I found out in retrospect that apparently she had several licenses from surrounding states, nicely laminated, and was using them for certain purposes that I will pretend to remain in denial about. But if I knew then what I knew now, boy, would there have been trouble. Enough about that. I've got another memorization technique for this as well that may help those of you who have been in the clinical world, because there's a back surgery that's performed very commonly called a laminectomy. Ectomy means remove. Lamina refers to this little layer or plate of bone. Say somebody has a ruptured disc or a herniated disc and the surgeon wants to repair it. What do they do? They have the patient on the operating table, so the back is facing them. Because if you want to do back surgery, you have to have the back of the patient facing you in order to operate on it. And when they have the back of the patient facing them, they make an incision so they can reach down and grab this lamina, cut it out. They'll pull that piece of bone away, repair the ruptured disc, and then put the piece of bone back. So that's another way I remember that the lamina is the layer or plate of bone in the back. Someone who had nothing better to do also decided to give a name to this little piece of bone right here. It's between the transverse process and the body of the vertebrae, and it's called the pedicle. Know your root words. Ped means feet. And the way I never forget this is I just have a mental image. I picture a foot kicking the body. Just remember, the foot kicks the body, and you'll always get it correct that the pedicle is the piece that joins into the body. That's my memorization technique. Of course, you're more than welcome to come up with your own. We're not done yet, though, because I suppose that same person said, hey, look, if you put the pedicles and the lamina all together, it forms like an arch, doesn't it? Like a McDonald's arch right around the vertebral foramen. And I will call that arch of bone consisting of the lamina and pedicles, I will call that the vertebral arch. I know, that's lots of names, but I'm just the messenger. With that information in hand, we're ready to go to the real deal. Here's a superior view of a photo I took of a thoracic vertebrae in the lab. This is anterior. This is posterior. Let's do the parts. The big hunk of beef right here, that large chunk of bone, of course, it's called the body, because the biggest part of many organs in the body are called the body. Then we go to the hole. You know the hole's called a foramen. This one here is called a vertebral foramen, which you know houses and protects the spinal cord. Let's do the process, poking straight off the back. Remember, before you took the course, you felt that running up and down your back, those ridges, and called that your spine. Well, now for real, you'll just call it the spinous process, because that's what it really is. Off to the side, projections of bone must be processes, and we will call them the transverse processes. What about the other little chunks and plates we have to know? Here's the little layers in the back, the flat piece between the two processes. You call that the lamina. What's the chunkier piece that kicks into the body? You will all, I hope, call that the pedicle. Together, they form the McDonald's arch around the vertebral foramen that you will all call, yes, the vertebral arch. How about another view? I love this picture. This is a right lateral view of a typical thoracic vertebrae. My main point on this slide is not to review the parts. You know the parts. You know that here's the big body up front anteriorly. You know that's a transverse process. You know this is a spinous process. The point of this slide is to allow you to identify this as a thoracic vertebrae. Thank goodness for our course, we don't ask you to name each of the 12 thoracic vertebrae individually. That's just way too much trivial pursuit. But you must know it is a thoracic vertebrae. And the key is on the slide. Always check out the spinous process, because in a thoracic vertebrae, mark my words, write them down, it's long, thin, slender, pointy, but most importantly, downward sloping. And you'll never miss it if you know that one thing. Here comes next a posterior view of a thoracic vertebrae. And I love this because it gives me a visual. For those who are visual, I love this. Does anybody see something? Anybody see an animal? I see a giraffe. Sometimes people tell me they see an elephant. I don't care which one you see, as long as it sticks in your brain good. Once I see a giraffe or an elephant with the long downward sloping nose, which is really the spinous process in this posterior view, I know I'm looking at a thoracic vertebrae. And the pieces, again, are easy. The processes off to the side, those have to be the transverse processes. Remember the other piece from this view you may get asked, what's the name of this little layer or plate of bone that's between the processes? Or How about we say between the ears and the nose, right? How about that? These would be like the cheeks. If they tag the cheeks, call that the lamina. So that's my visual that always works for me on this bone. Moving on down, literally moving on down, here comes a lumbar vertebrae. It's a superior view. So this would be anterior. This would be posterior. Are the basic parts we learned there? Of course they are. The big hunk of beef, you call that the body. The hole in the middle for the spinal cord is the vertebral foramen. Here we have processes to the side. You're all going to say transverse process. The one that pokes out the back, that's the spinous process. We have the layers or plates of bone between the processes. Those are the lamina. And then the piece that kicks the body. Remember, the foot always kicks the body. So you will call that little piece the pedicle. But the key thing really here is, it's how do you know this is a lumbar vertebrae? Aha! I know what a lot of you are thinking. You're thinking, well, look how big the body is. And I know the lumbar vertebrae have the biggest bodies, and they do because they have to support the whole weight of the body above. But on the test, in the lab especially, they might whip out a little baby lumbar vertebrae, or they might whip out a teenager lumbar vertebrae. So what's the trick? First of all, you know it's not a cervical vertebrae because there are no transverse foramen. So they're out of the picture. Then the key is it thoracic or lumbar? Look at the spinous process. On a lumbar vertebrae, again, mark my words, write it down, they're shorter, they're thicker, they're straighter, they're blunt. You want to see the side view? Because that really tells the whole story. Right lateral view, lumbar vertebrae. How do I know? Look at the spinous process. Short, straight, thick, blunt. There's no downward slope. There should be no confusion on the test. I don't care which lumbar vertebrae they use. That is the key. Then what I like to do is the posterior view of a lumbar vertebrae. Because I got another cool visual again. Anybody see an animal? I do. I see a moose. Please somebody see a moose besides me so I can feel semi-normal. Here is the nose. Of course, that's really the blunt, thick, short spinous process. Here are the cheeks. The cheeks between the processes are not called cheeks. They're called the lamina. Then poking off to the sides on this posterior view, you can still see the transverse processes. The next slide is beautiful. It allows us to do some review, learn some new things, and get clinical. Here is a drawing, a right lateral view showing several vertebrae as we just discussed. This is anterior, this is posterior. Shown in yellow is the delicate, precious spinal cord being protected by the bony vertebral column as it cruises through the vertebral cavity. What I want to focus on, though, is something new shown in baby blue called an intervertebral disc with triple red stars. I wouldn't have put them stars up there if I didn't think it was important. First, let's focus on the name, because in anatomy, a name often tells you what it is, where it is, or what it does. Let's break it down. Inter means in between. Vertebrae means vertebrae. And disc means a disc. They're discs in between the vertebrae, specifically in between the bodies of the vertebrae. What are they made out of? They're made out of fibrous connective tissue, specifically fibrocartilage, mostly on the outside of the disc. But on the inner part of the disc is sort of a soft, chewy center, a special Tootsie Pop center. That's not the name. The real name you must put on a test is nucleus pulposus. You should have that written down in front of you on my lecture notes. What does that mean? Nucleus means it's in the middle, and pulp just means junk, like the soft, chewy junk that's inside of orange juice, for example. What's the purpose of these discs? Well, they do provide some strength and also some flexibility. They act as shock absorbers. They will, in compressive injuries, protect us to some extent, but if the injury is overwhelming, what can happen is the intervertebral discs can get squished and result in a condition called a slipped disc or a herniated disc that I bet many of you heard of. Now, that doesn't mean that usually the entire disc just slips back here like a cookie. Usually it means that when the bodies press on the disc, it squishes out the soft, chewy inner center. In other words, the nucleus pulposus gets squished out. It presses on these spinal nerves and can cause damage, which can lead to things like paralysis, numbness, tingling, and so forth. I want to mention one more thing relevant to real life that you should know about that connects with these intervertebral discs. You may have heard that we're a little bit taller in the morning and a little bit short at night. Do you think that's truth or do you think that's a myth? It's actually true. What happens is during the day, the pressure on these discs causes them to compress, and also during the day they tend to dehydrate, which also leads to shrinkage. Then as we're sleeping, they rehydrate, and of course the pressure is off, so to speak, so they can expand a little bit. We are a little bit taller in the morning and a little bit shorter in the nighttime. See, you can tell your parents you learned something useful in anatomy today. I want to keep it clinical on the next slide. Here's a photo of a specimen you'll study in the lab. This is mostly a posterior but also slightly lateral view, including all five lumbar vertebrae. Yes, they are the largest and the strongest in the human body. They have to be in order to support the total weight of the body sitting on top of them. On this slide down below are other pieces of the vertebral column we'll study shortly, and the hip bones are slapped on as well. We'll talk some more about them later. I want to talk to you about why you're taking this course. Are you really just taking this course to get an A? I hope you all do. If you did, I'd brag about it. I'd show it off to all the other instructors. But really, I hope you're taking this course because you want to help people. And I'm going to give you an example of something shortly of how you have to know this anatomy stone cold in order to be able to safely help someone. You have all probably heard of a procedure called a spinal tap. Maybe you've seen one done, maybe you had one done, maybe you'll do one in the future. And it's really easy to do if you know your stuff. I'll give you an example. When I was a third year med student, I was doing a neurology rotation, and the attending physician and I were seeing a patient with mad cow disease, an incurable fatal disease. And he turned to me and said, "Dr. Gonshore," and I wasn't even a doctor yet, I still was a lowly medical student with my short white coat on. He said, "Dr. Gonshore, how would you like to do a spinal tap?" And I'm thinking to myself, on one hand, I would love to do a spinal tap because I've never done one before. But on the other hand, this patient has a uniformly fatal disease which is potentially transmissible through bodily fluids. But you know how it goes. The attending physician's at the top of the hill, med student at the bottom of the hill, and stuff rolls downhill. So of course I had to do it. I must mention, when I was doing the spinal tap, the attending physician, he left the room. This is how I did it. This is how you do a spinal tap. Have the patient lay down on a table on their side with their back facing you, of course. Then what you do is you draw a line right across the top of the hip bones. We'll learn later that the tops of the hip bones are called the iliac crest because they look like crests. When you draw a line across the top of the hip bones, it just so turns out that that will run right across the spinous process of lumbar vertebrae number 4, which you can feel very nicely when you palpate the patient's back. That is a critically important landmark while doing a spinal tap, because you'll learn that the spinal cord in the average adult human being ends up at lumbar vertebrae number 2. You don't want to insert the spinal tap needle into the spinal cord. That's generally considered to be poor form, which can result in all sorts of bad players, again, such as paralysis, and the lawyers will never forgive you for that. Fortunately, the sacs that surround, the membranes that surround the spinal cord that contain the spinal fluid, continue way down lower beyond the end of the spinal cord, so we can access it in a safe place. Now that we have this landmark in a safe zone, the next thing you do is you ask the patient to curl forwards so that they're in a fetal type position. Why? because that separates the gap between lumbar vertebrae number 4 and lumbar vertebrae number 5, spinous processes. And you could feel that divot of soft tissue between those two bony landmarks. Now you have your choice spot. Next on the list, you numb them up there. Once you numb the skin up, believe it or not, it should be a relatively painless procedure, other than feeling a little bit of pressure. Because unless you rake your spinal tap needle across the bone, which really hurts by the way, all they're gonna feel is a little bit of pressure. Now we're ready to whip out the syringe with the spinal tap needle. Do not show the needle to the patient. It looks like it's about 8 inches long. They will freak out and jump off the table. Slowly but surely, advance that needle in the soft tissue space between the two spinous processes we just marked. Then you will feel a pop when you reach the connective tissue membranes containing the spinal fluid. You can actually feel the pop through the syringe. Then advance a little bit further and a little bit of clear fluid will start percolating out. And then you know you're in the right space. Out comes the fluid where you can sample it and do your thing. Now that we know how to do a spinal tap, a couple things I want to mention before leaving this slide. First of all, mad cow disease has an incubation period that measures in decades. So far, I think I'm pretty normal and hope I'm out of the woods, but I'll just keep my fingers crossed. Second of all, one time after I gave this talk in a face-to-face classroom situation, later that evening, a student called me at home. And she said, "Dr. Gonshore, I'm really not sure exactly how to do this spinal tap. I don't know if I'm getting this right." I'm thinking, uh-oh, this is bad. Number one, don't call the professor at home. That's considered to be poor form. Number two, she scared the living daylights out of me because I thought she was like doing one at home while we were talking. Do not do anything I say how to do. This is for informational purposes only. Just learn the stuff. On the next slide, we're going to progress inferiorly to do the last two bones of the vertebral column. We'll start with this drawing, a posterior view of those last two bones. Let me do the simple stuff for lab first. This bone here on top, shaped like a triangle, real funky looking bone, is called the sacrum. On the lab test, it's easy because there's only one question, only one answer. Name this bone, you say sacrum. And once you see it in lab, you'll never forget it. Again, it's this triangular shaped, funky looking bone. It's kind of scooped out on the anterior surface as we showed when we were studying the normal curves of the vertebral column. The other thing for lab is this bone here. Don't call it the tip of the tailbone. We'll just laugh a little bit, but you don't get any points for that. You will call this final piece the coccyx. Let's break it down for lecture now. I want you to pay attention and know this surface here on the sides of the sacrum are what form a joint with the hip bones. I want you to know the name of that joint. It's called the sacroiliac joint. That is spelled out in my notes further on in the skeletal system PowerPoints. For right now, you can abbreviate because most people, like on the weekends, my friends who are in my group I'm drinking Pepsi with, we all just call it the SI joint, which stands for sacroiliac joint. The reason I want you to know that is because it is x-rayed frequently, not just in trauma cases, but it's a place where often certain types of arthritis will show up first, and it's your first clue. So know the SI joint. Let's move on to a bony projection on the lower back sides of the sacrum. These little horny projections are called sacral cornu with a red star. Corn, root word, means like a horn, and they are bony, horny projections, in between which is an opening called the sacral hiatus. Hiatus in anatomy just means an opening. Why is this important clinically? Because you will see women who are pregnant maybe need a little extra pain relief. A term for a type of anesthesia called caudal anesthesia may be performed in that situation, where the anesthesiologist will palpate very easily these little bony projections called the sacral cornu, feel the space in between them, and again, that's a safe place to inject numbing medicines where you just will get anesthesia of the lower nerves that will help out a woman with the pain in that pregnancy situation. What about a little more info on the coccyx? The coccyx is actually a fusion of, in general, 3 to 5 vertebrae. Let's check out the real deal. Here is an anterior view of both the sacrum and the coccyx together. You can see the lines of fusion, by the way, between the 5 vertebrae that actually make up the one sacrum. Same thing with the coccyx, by the way. But in lab, what they tend to do is separate these bones, so be ready. There's an anterior view of the sacrum only. Triangular shaped bone, it roots into the hip bones, it forms a very strong foundation for our bodies as it anchors into the hip bones. Nothing else really looks like this. Please, I hope it's a gimme come a testing situation. Then they pull out the coccyx separately, so I photographed it in the lab for you. Again, you can see here, it looks like a fusion of about 3 vertebrae. But what about a visual on this one? You know what it looks like to me? I see a rattlesnake tail. And when I see the rattlesnake tail immediately on the lab, I write down coccyx and I get it correct every time. Hopefully, you all are getting visuals that work for you. We're going clinical again on the next slide to show you the relevance of this stuff. This is the back of a little baby. This cystic-like looking structure is something you might have heard of called spina bifida. What it represents is an abnormal fusion of our bones during embryology where the bones don't come together and form a complete tube. As a whole, these things are called neural tube defects, and they can affect anything from the top of the head and brain all the way to the tip of the spinal column. There are also various degrees of severity where the baby may be born dead or with paralysis or with minimal defects whatsoever. By the way, if you see this, don't go mashing on this, because if the patient isn't already paralyzed, if you go mashing on that thing, the spinal cord might be right underneath that thin structure and you may cause further damage. This defect and others like it are associated with deficiencies in a B vitamin called folic acid. That's why pregnant women are routinely given folic acid supplements to try to decrease this type and other types of defects. We're ready to progress on the axial skeleton with this real deal thoracic cage staring straight at you from a real human skeleton. I think this slide is so cool, as my son would say, this slide is sick, and it is sick. Let's check out the thoracic cage. The thoracic cage means just the bones that surround and protect the thorax or our chest region. What does the thoracic cage consist of, if somebody asks you? Number one, the sternum, which we will break down first. It also consists of our ribs, shown very nicely here. And finally, the thoracic cage consists of, posteriorly, the 12 thoracic vertebrae. This is a great picture to do some basics about ribs. Let's take a look at the ribs that are numbered from 1 to 12 on the right side of this photograph. Well, somebody decided to break these ribs down into categories and subcategories, and we have to know them. I'm just a messenger, so here we go. The first 7 ribs are called true ribs. Why? Because their costal cartilages, shown here in brown, connect directly to the sternum. They are also called, for that same reason, vertebrosternal ribs, because they have a connection to the vertebrae as well as directly to the sternum. Now, I'm generally not big on synonyms because you have enough names to learn in anatomy. I'll only use them when I know they're used in the clinical world for real or when they tend to pop up in testing situations. What about the last 5 ribs, 8 through 12? They are called the false ribs. Why? Because they do not have a connection directly to the sternum. Furthermore, for our studying pleasure, someone has subdivided the false ribs into two groups. Ribs 8 through 10 are called vertebrochondral ribs because they have a connection to the vertebrae and their costal cartilages connect into the cartilage of the ribs above. Therefore, they're called vertebrochondral. Chondral, root word, refers to cartilage. What about the last two ribs, number 11 and 12? They have two names. They are called the floating ribs, or sometimes just called vertebral ribs, because their only bony connection is to the vertebrae. Again, hate to slap all that terminology on you, but it's something we all have to know. And once you really have the basics, it's not that hard. Let's break this bad boy down and start to look at the pieces one at a time, starting by sawing out mostly the sternum. We'll take it out. We'll slap it on the next slide. Here's a photo I took of a specimen you'll study in lab. It shows the sternum in white. Before today, maybe you called that the breastplate. That's only good for one thing, to let you know that these are flat bones, and if you look at them edge on, they are flat like a plate. But other than that, don't call it breastplate anymore, because you're not going to score any points. You're going to call it the sternum. And furthermore, for our studying pleasure, it has been broken down into three individual pieces that you must know. Also on this slide, there are these things in sort of a light brown or tan color. Those are the rib cartilages called costal cartilages. Know your root word, costal means rib. Let's start at the top. This piece at the top I'm outlining now has a name all by itself. You will all call it the manubrium. Manubrium means like a handle. And it is kind of like a handle. If you grab onto that thing from the top, it feels like a handle or like a stick shift, I guess. But the way I remember it, is I look at the top of the manubrium and it always has an M on it. Can you see the M? I'm tracing it now. I know it's a poor excuse for an M. It's like a flattened, squashed M, but it's always there. It's the only bone with an M on it, and that's how I never miss it. For lecture class, we have to know a couple more things. This little notch right in the top middle part of the manubrium, in the middle of the M, so to speak, has a name. It's called the suprasternal notch because it's in the notch in the top part of the sternum. Clinical significance, you should know, you will check that landmark. It's easy to feel. I'm not telling you to feel it, but it's easy to find that suprasternal notch. And for example, when I had to put catheters or get intravenous access into the subclavian vein, that was one of the key landmarks we used to hit the spot correctly, so to speak. The other things you have to know are these two notches off to the side of the M, or the sides of the manubrium. These top side notches are called the clavicular notches because that's where we form one of the joints with the clavicle. Let's move down to the next piece of the sternum. It's the biggest hunk of beef of the sternum, and if you recall, many organs have their biggest hunk of beef called the body, and sure enough, it works here. If they say, name this part, name this piece on the test, you call it body, and you get your free points on the test. Last but not least, the third part of the sternum is this sharp thing poking down. It's a process, because it's a projection, called the xiphoid process. Xiphoid means sword-like, because it is a sharp, sword-like process. Interestingly, it doesn't become calcified till we turn about 40 years of age. So most of you listening to this tape, probably it's still cartilage, to tell you the truth. Of clinical note, during CPR, that is a useful landmark. You will all do cardiopulmonary resuscitation in healthcare, likely. You will use the xiphoid process as a landmark. Now, one of the things that could happen to that process is it can get cracked or broken. That's not necessarily in and of itself a big tragedy. However, if CPR is over aggressive, you can drive that xiphoid process into internal organs while you're doing deep compressions and lacerate things like the liver. Now, that is considered poor form. Even if you do save the patient's life, of course, that's great. But you don't want them to wake up with all kind of lacerations of internal organs. Well, just when you thought you had it all down, how do they do it on the bone lab practical examination? Like this, they pluck out the bone separately. First, let's yank off the manubrium, and there it is, blown up view, real human bone. And here is my M. I promise you it always has an M, okay? So don't miss it. For lecture, suprasternal notch, right in the middle. We got a divot there, and then off to the sides we have our clavicular notches to form a joint with the clavicle. They also suck out the body separately. This is the body of the sternum. If they say name this piece, you write down body and you get free points. Be ready for it pulled out separately. On edge, again, if you turn these bones sideways, they are rather flat bones, which is helpful in identifying them as well. I've never seen them pull out the xiphoid process before. In my mind, if they ever pull that out and tag that separately, I just think that's wrong. That's just me. Don't tell anybody I said that. Moving right along, we're going to hit the ribs now. For lab test, it's easy. There's only one question usually and only one answer. If you see a rib, you write down RIB, rib, and you got the points. Some instructors like you to know the first ribs or the last ribs separately, so I'll show them to you. This is the first rib. This has the characteristics of all ribs. How do I know it's a rib? All ribs are curved. Kind of like a C. You will see that they have different degrees of curvature. So number one, they're curved. Number two, they're flat. If you turn them on edge, and even in this slide, you can get an idea that these are rather flat bones. How about some more ribs, more from the middle of the thoracic cage? That's a typical rib, has the two characteristics that I mentioned. It is curved, it is rather C-shaped. And if you grab it in your hands, which you should, you will feel that they are rather flat. Oh, what about that one? That's one they love to whip out on a test. That's a real human rib I took a photo of from the lab. It is one of the floating ribs. Therefore, it is one of the five false ribs. Does it have the characteristics? Some of you are thinking, no, it doesn't. Oh, yes, it does. Look at it. First of all, on edge, I promise you, in 3D, when you grab it and feel it, it is rather flat. Is it curved? Yeah, it is. It's not perfectly straight, but it does have a curve. All ribs are flat and have some degree of a curve. I'll show you another one I'd like to rip out. That's probably rib number 12. That is one of the floating ribs. It's a real human bone. It has a little curve to it, not much, but it sure isn't straight as an arrow, and it's flat. That's how I know I'm always looking at a rib. Oh, some of you look at this one and say, wait a minute, is this a rib? No, this is not a rib. If you are really paying attention, you all know this is the hyoid bone. Why? Because this is an absolutely perfect shaped U. And it really isn't flat on edge like you'll see the ribs have a flat edge. Please don't ever miss this. Plus the hyoid bone has the horns on it, right? The little fangs as well. Compare that to rib number one. I know you're thinking, hey, that looked exactly like rib number one. Did it really? Well, I'll show it to you again. There's rib number one. It's more like a C-shaped curve. It's flat for sure, and sure ain't a perfect U. No excuse for flip-flopping them on the test and missing any points now that I gave it all away. I love this picture to wind things down. It's a great way to summarize, get a few extras in that you need to know, of course, for the lecture class as well. This is a drawing posterior view, including of a few of the vertebrae as well as several ribs. Couple things extra you need to know for my course. You need to know a part of the rib where it articulates with or joins with part of the vertebrae is called the head. So the head of the rib makes a joint with the vertebrae. The next part I want you to know is the costal angle showed right there. It's where the rib makes an angle. It ain't rocket science. The importance is This is where ribs often fracture. And rib fractures are some of the most common bone fractures in the human body. They can range from mild and don't really need any treatment to severe, where they damage internal organs and can even cause loss of life. In the old days, the minor rib fractures, we thought we were helping by bandaging the patients, but the really minor ones that didn't need surgery, we found out that the bandaging actually made things worse because the patients couldn't take good deep breaths in and out, and they had a higher incidence of pneumonia. So the really, really minor rib fractures, we don't even bandage anymore. You're probably noticing one more thing on this slide because it has a big blue box around it and a ginormous red star. It's called the intercostal space, and it is exactly where and what it says it is. Inter means in between. Costal means rib. Space means space. It's the space between the ribs. And there's lots of goodies in there that you must know. And you must write them down because they're not anywhere else to be found on this slide. Inside that space are muscles that will help us raise and lower our rib cage so we can breathe. Inside that space are also blood vessels and nerves. And guess what? They're called intercostal muscles, intercostal nerves, and intercostal arteries, and intercostal veins. It ain't rocket science, or I wouldn't do it. This once again shows you how the bones are used as a basis for learning terminology that will help you as we progress on through the human body. That's why it's one of the first things we start with in the lecture and in the lab. I want to get clinical here before we leave this slide and tell you about a true story. You all will see trauma victims with chest wounds such as gunshot wounds, stab wounds. And I was doing a rotation through the ER one day. Someone had a stab wound pierced in the intercostal space, punctured the lung, so they were dying because they had a punctured lung. And the treatment for a punctured lung, you may know, is something called insertion of a chest tube. You can do an internet search on it if you have the stomach for it. But what you do basically is you put a big plastic tube in between the ribs, you kind of hook it up to suction, and that helps to reinflate the lung against the chest wall. But here's the deal. You know what's in the intercostal space, right? Intercostal nerves. Those nerves really are tender. The thing that all of you will never forget, and I never did, if you ever see a chest tube performed or ever do one, is it's painful. The patients are just wincing in pain. And I remember doing my first one, I was sitting there trying to numb the patient up, and the attending physician's looking at me. He said, what are you doing? The patient's dying. You don't have time to numb them up. So I just shoved that tube in there, you know, got it the lung, reinflate it back up. But I'll never forget the pain that that patient was in while I was trying to save their life. I think this is a nice note to end on for the axial skeleton. Next time we get together, we'll start marching our way through the appendicular skeleton.